Thanks very much, Mark, and good evening, everybody. Well, this is the third night of topics that have been dealt with by the fellowship here. And, of course, they've been very difficult topics, and yet I think that's a very useful thing, because very often it's dealing with those difficult topics that touches some of the most important and deepest issues for us in life. And this evening we come to perhaps one of the most difficult topics that we could face in life, and it's the issue of suicide. Suicide, of course, is a tragic event, and probably some of you here have been left shocked or stunned in your life at some point by hearing of someone who has taken their own lives. It's difficult to understand, and there aren't any easy answers to this whole question of suicide. In fact, whilst there aren't any easy answers, very often it leaves us with plenty of questions more than anything else. How could it happen? What causes a suicide? Is there anything that I can do to help someone in that situation? And in the midst of it all, where can I find real hope in this life? And I hope that those are some of the very difficult questions that we'll try to begin to find some answers to this evening. Now, this is my little gun here. I hope this works okay. I'm pointing it in the wrong direction. There we go. Let's look a wee bit now at the beginning about this whole question of how common a problem suicide is. In Ireland, suicide is the commonest cause of death amongst young people. It's more common, for example, than road traffic accidents, which we hear about often in the media. In Northern Ireland, in 1 year, there may be over 200 suicides. And it's a shocking statistic when you think about it, because if that was spread over the course of a year, it's roughly about four such events happening every week just across the border in the province. And that's the number of people that are actually completing suicide. The numbers attempting suicide are far greater, probably even 10 times that number. And so if we take all of that together, then what we are probably looking at is a number of people every day throughout the length of Ireland attempting to commit suicide. That's the scale of the issue that we're facing in our topic this evening. Well, have there been changes in these kind of statistics over the years? And the answer is yes, there have been. The number of suicides has increased by about sixfold in the last 4 to 5 decades. And that increase has been greater in the bracket of young men, that age group between about 15 and 30, and particularly with men. And so we're seeing that for some reason, increasingly, young men in our community are more vulnerable to this problem of suicide. And so the question that comes to our minds then is why? Why does it happen? Why is there suicide? What kind of person then might be at risk of committing suicide? And that brings us all into the whole issue of risk factors. Now, it's important just to highlight at the beginning that a risk factor is not a cause. For example, to say that divorce is a risk factor for suicide is different from saying that divorce causes suicide. Of course, not everyone who gets divorced commits suicide. But of those that have committed suicide, divorce is more likely amongst those people. It's a risk factor. And so let's go through and see what some of the risk factors are this evening. And as we go through them, I want you to think about this question. What is the pattern to these risk factors? What is the common thread that these risk factors have as we go through them? First of all, does age play a part? And the answer is yes, it does. And despite what I mentioned a few moments ago about young men, it's actually the elderly that are at greatest risk in the community. Probably for a whole number of reasons. Perhaps it's because of illness, or because of bereavement, or even just isolation and loneliness. So age does play a part. Are men and women different? Well, actually they are. Men are at greater risk of suicide than women by about a ratio of 3 to 1. Men are 3 times more likely to commit suicide. Men are also more likely to commit suicide by more violent means, for example, by hanging or by use of firearms and so on. Does being married affect risk? Well, again, it does. The divorced, as we've mentioned, are more at risk. Also those who are widowed and then those who are single. And it seems that the support and the stability of marriage may be some kind of protective factor in suicide. Does having a job help? And again, the answer is yes, it does. Employment, again, and perhaps the sense of purpose that a job brings does seem to be a protective factor because the unemployed are at greater risk. And what about living circumstances? Does that have any part to play? Again, the answer is yes, that those that are living alone are at greater risk of suicide. Again, isolation is probably a feature there. What about this statement, religious people wouldn't commit suicide? Well, of course, that's not true. However, research has shown that those who have a faith, and not only who have a faith, but also practice their faith, are at less risk of suicide. So religion seems to have some kind of protective factor for people. It may also be that in Irish society, that the lessening influence of the church in general may have a role to play in the increasing rates of suicide here. Does your health count? Well, it does, and those with physical illnesses, particularly those illnesses that have chronic pain, are at greater risk. What about this question? If you've tried before, what about those that have attempted suicide previously or who have committed self-harm? Up to half of those who commit suicide do have a history of deliberately self-harming. And that can be in a number of forms. The common forms today would be things like self-cutting and overdosing and those kinds of problems. Now, very often self-harming is quite different from suicide, just to mention this for a moment, because it is quite common in our communities today, especially amongst young people. Very often those who self-harm do not have the intention to really kill themselves. In fact, for them, self-harming is a means really of coping. And the pattern seems to be that they find, for all kinds of reasons that we don't really have time to go into, but they find that they have a build-up of tension and very unpleasant feelings within. And then that build-up of tension gets so great that for some reason the cutting or self-harming seems to bring relief to that. And when they get the relief, that then creates a cycle of the person harming again to cope with the unpleasant feelings. It seems to be a way of dealing with pain and with distress inside. But certainly it is a risk factor for later suicide. Do people who commit suicide have psychiatric problems? And the answer is that more often than not, they do. Mental disorders have a major impact on suicide risk. And again, research has shown that up to 9 out of 10 cases of suicide have some history of mental disorder in the broadest sense. And amongst the most common disorders are things like alcohol abuse, depression, especially in the early stages of depression, where someone is beginning to feel depressed and is maybe confused and wondering what's wrong with them. And other mental illnesses are also relevant, things like schizophrenia. So then, those are some of the risk factors. I wonder, did you see any pattern coming through in those factors this evening? Whenever you think about it and think your way through those various factors that we discussed, one thing that they seem to have in common is that they all contain some kind of disappointment, some kind of expectation that has failed, whether it's been in a relationship or with our health or with employment or with some other aspect of our life. It's been some experience in which life has not lived up to its promises and there has been some kind of shattered hope. We could take marriage as an example. Most people walking down the aisle have a lot of optimism for the life that's ahead of them. They think that they're going to enjoy their married life and have companionship and it will be very fulfilling. They'll expect happiness and comfort and a family if possible. They don't expect it to end in divorce. And so whenever, sadly, in some situations, divorce, separation comes, then we have the shattering and the failure of all of those expectations that there were at the beginning of the marriage. And so that seems to be a pattern, a common thread through these risk factors. Well, let's move on then for a moment to talk about a more practical aspect of this issue. What can we do? How can we help someone who is at risk? And here are some do's and don'ts in terms of helping people who may be at risk of suicide. The first one, if you're able to read it from the back there, is don't be afraid to ask. Don't be afraid to ask. Very often there's a myth out there which goes like this, that if we ask someone about harming themselves or suicide, we may put it into their minds to do that and increase the risk. In reality, it's the opposite that happens, because if someone is already beginning to think along those lines and we then ask them if they've been feeling that way, usually they're very relieved to be able to talk about that and to unburden themselves to someone. And that being able to share the problem tends to reduce and to diminish the risk. So don't be afraid to ask. The next point is don't be thrown off course, because there is another myth. And it goes something like this, that those who talk about suicide all the time never do it. And it is a myth, because sometimes those who do talk a lot about it do actually end up taking their own lives. Now, how can we know when that will happen if someone is continually threatening to harm themselves in some way? Well, we have to sometimes look beneath the surface and try to understand, why is this person constantly making these kind of threats? There must be some reason for that. Why are they constantly seeking help and attention in that kind of manner? Another thing we should look out for is sometimes if someone is repeatedly threatening to harm themselves or to commit suicide, to see if there are any changes then in their circumstances or in their presentation, in their personality. And sometimes that kind of change can alert you to the fact that there might be a difference here, that this person might be more at risk on this occasion. Don't be thrown off course. Another point is do be on the lookout. We've listed a lot of the risk factors. It's important then that we watch out for people who may be at risk and may be suffering from some of those circumstances in life. When we do think there is someone who is at risk, it's good then to try and offer some practical help. Very often, if we know that someone is beginning to feel hopeless or feel this way, we struggle, don't we, to find the right words to say to them. How do we bring comfort? How do we bring support? One way of being able to do that is just to offer practical help, to be a companion, to offer friendship, to be with them, to stay with them if they're feeling unsafe, and to offer that kind of practical support. That can speak an awful lot more than our words sometimes, offering practical help. Another very important point is making safety a priority. And I suppose one thing just to mention on that point is be very wary of taking any information in confidence. Be very wary of someone saying to you, look, I'm going to tell you something now, but I don't want you to tell anybody else. Because really, if someone gives you information like this, you cannot keep their confidence. It's very important that you seek other help for the safety of that person. So be very wary of receiving information in confidence and make the person's safety a priority. Make sure that the person is kept safe by bringing in other help if necessary. And that brings us on to the last point. Do encourage the person to seek help. If someone unburdens themselves to you in this way, it can be very hard to take the burden of that kind of information just on your own. So encourage the person to seek help from their GP, from a relative, from a friend, from someone else with whom they can also share this burden. And especially if you think there's maybe some kind of mental illness involved, it's very important that medical help would be sought by the individual. Well, how do I ask someone whenever I think there might be a risk of them harming themselves? Well, I suppose there are a few principles. Obviously, it's a very difficult and very sensitive area to ask about. Not everyone will feel very comfortable trying to talk about this issue with people. But if we do find ourselves ever in that kind of situation, I think one rule of thumb is to begin gently. And to begin with very open, general questions, just asking how the person is, how they're feeling, how things are going at the moment. And once the person then begins to talk and to open up, well, then we can begin to narrow down the questioning if we think there seems to be some risk. We can begin to ask questions like, well, how do you see the future? How do you feel about life these days? Do you feel life is worthwhile? Do you ever feel it isn't worthwhile? And so you're beginning in a very gentle, general way, but beginning then to focus the questions a bit more if you're concerned about the person. And remember again that very often the individual who's feeling this way may feel very ashamed of how they're feeling, may feel guilty about it, may find it very hard to talk to someone about that. And so by you asking these questions gently, it probably helps them to unburden themselves and to share it with someone. And then, usually, certainly at a professional level, we move on to very much more specific questions and ask them things like, well, do you ever feel like ending it all? Have you ever felt like harming yourself? And if we do begin to see some positive answers to those questions, then we have to really be very specific and ask them, well, have you any plans made? We have to think about how feasible the plans are that the person is talking about. If they're thinking about using some kind of means of harming themselves, do they have access to those means? And so on. And as we ask those questions, we're trying to find out how genuine the risk is, how real the risk is, how likely is this person to see those plans through, how far have they thought it all through. Sometimes we can ask the person, have they their affairs sorted out? Have they made any of these last acts that people do sometimes before they commit suicide? And of course, we can also inquire about any of the risk factors that we mentioned at the beginning. finally, before we leave this section of what we can do, I think the bottom line is don't take risks. If you're worried about someone, encourage them to seek help. Go and seek help yourself. Keep them safe. And if you're worried about anything imminently, stay with them. Don't take risks. And also do encourage hope. Encourage them that there is a way forward, that there can be a way through whatever it is they're facing, whatever the disappointment is, whatever that hope is that seems to have been shattered in their life. There is a way forward and there is hope. I want to just take a few minutes then to move on to the whole issue of young people. As we mentioned at the beginning, in the whole trend of suicide over the last number of decades, it does seem to be amongst the young people that there are greater risks. And certainly in the area that I live in, earlier this year we had a spate of suicides amongst young men and also one or two young women, which were very, very concerning for the community at the time. So why young people? Young people who have their lives ahead of them, young people whose lives should be full of such optimism, and they should see a way forward in life. Why are young people increasingly turning to suicide? There are a number of factors, and one of the most common ones is depression. Depression. Between 1 in 10 and 1 in 20 adolescents get depressed. Now, in young people, it looks slightly differently than in adults. If you were at the first talk, I think it was a number of weeks back, you'll have seen what depression looks like in adults. Well, in young people, it's slightly different. In young people, it can present as moodiness and uncommunicativeness. They give up their interests. They don't replace then their interests with new ones. They perhaps lose interest in doing well at school. They find it hard to concentrate. They perhaps withdraw from their social circle. They lose touch with their friends. They don't look after themselves. Perhaps they don't eat enough. Perhaps they eat too much. They can become very self-critical, down on themselves. Again, their sleep may be affected. It may be that they're sleeping badly, but it can also be that they're sleeping too much. And so a list of those symptoms in someone, especially whenever it's out of character, especially when it's not their usual selves, that can indicate that there may be depression with them. There can be lots of reasons why depression affects young people. There can be a family history. It can be to do with difficulties at home. There may be a history of abuse. There can be a bereavement. And also today especially, sexual difficulties can lead to depression in young people. Young people struggling with maybe their sexual identity in a world which itself gives lots of confusing messages about what sexual identity is. And that can lead to depression in young people. And of course, with young people, there can be a kind of a culture of depression and even of suicide. It's a kind of a culture of pessimism. It's reflected in, I suppose, how they dress. It's reflected in the music that they listen to, sometimes associated with the drug culture, a fascination with death and with dying and with the darker side of things. And all of it can be fueled by the internet and by the access to this kind of culture that's so readily available today. And all of these things can lead to this syndrome of depression with young people. Oh, we're going the wrong direction, sorry. Suicide can also happen in young people if there's a family history, and for some reason there may be some kind of family history or genetic aspect even to suicide. Life events are a particularly common reason for suicide amongst young people. One of those common, difficult life events for young people is the breakup of a relationship. And that seems to be especially potent with young men. and particularly where that relationship has been a steady sexual relationship. The breakup of such relationships seems to be very threatening for a young man, maybe to do with the level of emotional maturity that a young man is at that time, maybe to do with the conflict that there is as the relationship splits up, or the loss just of the companionship. Other difficult life events for young people are, of course, things like bullying at school or even at work, and other shameful or humiliating experiences, perhaps at school, perhaps even failure academically, and of course the awful issue of abuse. Another group of young people that are at risk of suicide are those who engage in risky behaviours or risk-seeking behaviours, especially in the area of sexual relationships and drug taking. And young people who are caught up in those kind of culture seem to be more at risk. Again, we don't know exactly why this is. Is it to do with the young person themselves? Is it because they're a more impulsive kind of young person? Is it because they're disillusioned with the world? They're bored. They're unhappy. They're looking for fulfillment in life and not finding it. And then they're resorting to drugs and to sex in order to find that. Or again, this risky group of people may indulge more in alcohol abuse and again drug abuse, making them more impulsive and more likely to harm themselves. Another major issue for young people, I'm sorry that's so small, but it says seeking help. It's another major issue with young people. They are less likely to seek help, especially young men. And of course we can see how that then feeds into increasing the risk for young men. Young men are less willing to attend their GPs. They're more likely to see things like depression and mental health problems as just feeling sorry for yourself, something that you should be able to snap yourself out of, something that they don't want their friends and peers to know about. Less likely to seek help, and of course that places them all at greater risk. Let's move on again then and look at the issue of grief after suicide. What about those that are left behind? Now, at the last meeting, if you happen to be here, of course, the whole issue of grief and bereavement was talked about, and we're not going to go over that in a lot of detail this evening. But those that have been bereaved by suicide are left with many, many questions. And certainly one of the big issues that I've found in people that I've dealt with who have come through this is the feeling of guilt. Repeatedly looking back, asking themselves, could I have done more? Could I have done something, anything, to have prevented this tragedy? What if I had acted more quickly? What if I had listened then? What if I had intervened here? What if I had left my mobile phone on? What if I hadn't gone there and had been at home instead? Lots and lots of questions, very often lots of regrets. People very often think they should have seen it coming. They should have taken action. Maybe the person would have been here today if I had done this. And quite often associated with that kind of guilt and regret is anger at what has happened. It shouldn't have happened. Why am I left to pick up the pieces? The first thing to say about those kind of feelings is that they are very common and very natural after a tragedy like suicide. They're very intense and they can last for quite a while. And they are part of that normal process of grieving, of reacting to the loss. They're not abnormal. They're to be expected. Bereavement by suicide can be prolonged. And what are some of the features? Again, Brenda will have gone over these in a lot more detail, but that first phase of bereavement, that shock, that disbelief after suicide can be a lot more intense. the sense of social isolation then that comes afterwards. Feelings of shame and even stigma can be there in the weeks and months, perhaps even years afterwards. And of course that's reinforced because as the person who's left behind begins to go out and to meet people, people very often are stuck for what to say to them. And that then reinforces for that individual the sense of stigma and shame. And of course the bereaved person may ask why and embark on a very prolonged search for reasons and for explanations and for questions which don't have easy answers. Because no matter how much we try to analyse the event of suicide, we can never truly know what makes a person take that final step. If that long list of risk factors that we gave at the beginning tells us anything, it tells us that suicide is a very complex event. And that it's likely to be a whole number of different factors acting together and interacting with one another which finally lead the person to taking their own life. And very often for those that are left behind, it's coming to a point where they accept that really they can never fully know the answer. So what then do we say to someone who is bereaved after suicide? Well, I think we must understand some of those issues for them. We have to understand how they are feeling and what they are thinking. It's very important to be a listening ear and not to be too quick to speak and not to be too quick to try and give answers. Even people that are very close to the situation and close to the victim can have very differing views as to why it happened. And of course, everybody who's grieving is feeling very, very sensitive. And it's very, very easy to say the wrong thing and to say things that can be very hurtful. And so we're really better not to try and answer those questions, and certainly not in the early phase. It's a situation that will always be with that person to some extent. And trying to help them gain some level of acceptance to that, I think, is important. But most of all, trying to encourage hope. Trying to give them real, solid hope. And I suppose this evening that brings us back to the real question that we want to ask. We've looked at a whole possible range of risk factors for suicide. We saw that it often relates to disappointments and to losses. We saw things that are meant to give us hope in this life, at best being uncertain, things that we really can't depend on at all. And again, it's always difficult to know for us what was going through the mind of that person who committed suicide. And whilst I think we can't really know for certain, there's one thing that I think we can understand, is that at that point in time, that individual could not see another way forward. They did not have any expectation that good would come to them, that there was something to look forward to. They had lost hope. Hope had run out. I want to tell you briefly about a group of people who are facing the hardships of this life. If you had known them and were looking on at them, you might have thought that hope was running out for these people. They had marital issues. Some had stress at work from difficult employers. Some were being haunted by skeletons in their past. Some were being affected by unfair public slander. All the kind of things that would cause guilt and shame and disappointment. The very things that would undermine your hope in this life. Despite trying to live good, honest, solid lives, bad things seem to be coming their way. And we read about these people in the Bible. And in the Bible, the Apostle Peter wrote a letter to them. And in that letter, he says an amazing thing about those people. He says that in the midst of all of those disappointments and hardships and trials that they were facing, they were rejoicing. They were truly glad. Let me read you just a brief extract from this letter. This is what Peter writes to them. He says, "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who according to his abundant mercy has made us born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, to an inheritance that is incorruptible and undefiled and that doesn't fade away and that's reserved in heaven for you. You who are kept by the power of God through faith for salvation, which is ready to be revealed in the last time." And listen to what he says to them. He says, "In this you greatly rejoice, even though now for a little while in your life, if necessary, you've been grieved by various trials." Here were these people facing those disappointments. So much so, says Peter, that it was causing them the emotion of grief. And as we've seen this evening, and as you would have heard the last evening we were here, there's hardly a more painful, raw, difficult emotion than grief. Here were people whose life circumstances were causing them to grieve in that way. And the question for us this evening is, why were they so different? What was it about them? If they were facing so much suffering and difficulty, so many disappointments in their life, so much so that Peter says it's grieving them, how come that with those people there's no sign that their hope is running out? What made them so different from the majority of society today? What makes them so different? Well, what made them so different, says Peter, is that they had a living hope. They had a living hope. You see, this world, with all its pressures, with all of those circumstances that they were facing, this world was not their home. That was it. This life was not their home. The hardships they were facing were not home for them. The bereavements, the illness, the frailty, the depression, the relationship problems, the shameful, humiliating experiences, the abuse, none of that was their home. They knew that those things were not their inheritance. That's what was different. Things might have been bad for them in the present. Things might have been horrible and painful and grieving them. But they were confident that things would get better. They knew that good would come to them, and they knew it. It wasn't just wishful thinking. It wasn't just that they were trying to visualize the future in some kind of positive way and encourage themselves on. No, they were sure They were absolutely confident. They had real hope. The kind of hope that doesn't run out. And so that's why when the grief and the pain and the distress came their way, they could still have joy. They were suffering. Peter's very realistic about that. They were grieved by what was going on in their lives. But they were also rejoicing. Because they weren't rejoicing in their suffering. They were rejoicing in their hope. And the question for you this evening is, what about you? Where does your hope lie? I want you to ask yourself really honestly this evening, what am I hoping in? Are you sure that good will come your way? Do you have that kind of hope? Not the kind of hope that the world has. Not hope in the sense that the world often means it, that kind of uncertain, doubtful hope that everything might just turn out okay in the end. That's not hope. We're talking this evening about the kind of hope that God gives us. A confident hope, a hope that is certain of good that will come. And it's certain because God has said it. That inheritance, that future that we read about, God has promised it all. And his word cannot fail because it's the word of God. And here's the thing this evening, you can know that hope. You can know it by turning around and just putting all of your trust in Jesus Christ. That's all it takes. And you can have that kind of hope. And I'll guarantee you, in Christ, you will find a hope that will never run out. Thanks very much.